Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group is hosting a discussion on the constitutionality and the prudence of the proposed first-to-file rule under the America Invents Act, the current iteration of patent reform legislation that has been introduced in Congress every session since at least 2005. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. Participating on today's panel are law professors Adam Mossoff of George Mason University, Scott Keefe of George Washington Law School, David Olson of Boston College of Law, and Tim Holbrook of Emory Law School. I'm your moderator, David Applegate, a partner at the law firm of Williams, Montgomery & John in Chicago. In brief, the issue today is whether the United States can and should replace its current system of awarding patents to the first person to invent something that is new, useful, and non-obvious, and that meets all the procedural requirements of patent law, with a system that awards patents instead to the first to file a proper application for the invention. This proposal raises a host of practical and policy arguments, including whether the proposal is constitutional, and whether the United States currently truly even has a first-to-file system. Let's start by asking a few general questions for the panel to consider, bearing in mind that this podcast is scheduled for 1 hour, meaning that each person will have a little less than 15 minutes total speaking time. Gentlemen, let me throw out as a first question whether anyone on this podcast seriously contests that, in contrast to much of the rest of the world, the United States does currently have a first-to-invent system.
This is David Olson. So the way that's worded, I don't think I would contest that, or probably anyone else. Certainly, our whole system is designed to try to give the patent to the first person to invent within certain boundaries. But as we'll get into in this conversation, I'm sure there are a number of rules and technicalities that often, well, not often, but that from time to time mean that the patent, even in our current system, goes to a person who was not the first person in the world to invent something, but maybe was a second or third or fourth inventor to invent the same thing.
Would you like to explain briefly what we mean then by a first to invent versus a first to file system?
Sure. So under our first to invent system, unlike the rest of the world, where it's just a pure race to the patent office, whoever gets their patent application in first gets awarded the patent, much like a lot of jurisdictions do for real property. You know, whoever records a deed first to a piece of real property in many jurisdictions is the owner of that property. We have a different system called first, which we refer to as first to invent, where we say the first inventor who actually comes up with the inventive idea, conceives of it as the term, fully and operatively in his or her mind, gets the patent. Then there are certain rules that we follow if there's more than one inventor within a short space of time where we have to look at whether the first person to conceive was also diligent in reducing her invention to practice and whether she abandoned, suppressed, or concealed it. But, you know, so long as those details are worked through, then the U.S. system will give the invention to the first one to invent.
Professor Keith, what do you see as the comparative advantages of the current first-to-invent system as compared to the first-to-file system that is being proposed?
So I think that the main advantages of the existing first-to-invent system are that in contests where there are more than one inventor claiming to have the right to the patent, that it does make sense in those settings to go through the costs of an administrative process where one of them can look back to lab notebooks and show that he or she was first. I think that, as David Olson pointed out, there are advantages to land record or other real and tangible property titling systems basing their decisions around a filing date. But those advantages, I think, don't port over entirely to an intellectual property system like patents. And there are some advantages to a more searching review than inventorship requires for a patent system.
And would anyone care to defend the proposed first-to-file system?
This is David Olson. That's why I've been invited to this call, is my understanding, so I'll give it a shot. I think that there are a number of advantages to going to a first-to-file system. The first one, so let me outline them broadly at first, and then we can get down into the details of it as people are interested. So the first advantage, of course, is just harmonization internationally. The rest of the world uses a first-to-file system. We and pushes for us to also use that sort of system, pushes for us not to disadvantage inventors in other countries under 102G2 of our patent law, where only activity within the U.S. can go towards invention date for prior art purposes. And so it would give us some harmonization. Now, there are quibbles that can be made here that there are actually differences within first-to-file systems throughout the world, but notwithstanding that, it would basically be a step towards harmonization. So that's number one. Number two is that it would simplify the process of figuring out who does get the patent, right? The advantage of a kind of race to the patent office is whoever gets there first wins, so long as they didn't, you know, steal the invention from someone else. That's much simpler, and there's the advantage of that. There's also a large advantage that I haven't seen as I was preparing for this. I haven't seen talked about a lot, but I think there's a big advantage when it comes to litigating patents, in that under the current system, there's a lot of time and money wasted in litigation as people search for invalidating prior art. They search for inventions that were made by others out there that weren't public enough to qualify under 102A of the Patent Act, which says that if something was published or on sale or in use publicly, before someone else invents, it invalidates that patent application. Under 102G, it doesn't have to have been publicly in use before the claimed invention that someone wants to patent. Instead, the person simply has to have made that invention and thereafter not abandoned, suppressed, or concealed. So it should have come out into the public at a later time. Having litigated a number of patent cases, I can tell you we spent a lot of time trying to find third-party inventors, trying to figure out when we could say was the earliest at which they'd come up with an invention, trying to determine if that invention was the same invention as the one patented. And so, you know, lots of time in discovery, depositions, all of that sort of thing, you know, which would go away under first-to-file and would make that process a lot more simple. A related advantage is that under our current system, there are many occasions when you don't know for sure that a patent is valid because, again, of 102G2 prior art. You can have a patent that was filed. You might have an earlier product that was on sale, that went on sale, you know, less than a year earlier. And just giving you those facts and no more, we really have no idea whether the patent is valid or not. We'd have to know the invention date for the patented issue. We'd have to know the invention date for the product that went on sale before the patent was filed. So there's a lot of uncertainty that grows out of our current system. And a lot of that would go away under first to file because we would just look at who filed first. And, you know, that's the date of their invention. And then had someone disclosed the complete invention prior to that, and that would solve the priority dispute. So I think that's a large advantage as well.
This is Scott. So there are a couple of responses on the kind of utilitarian or prudential grounds in the debate between so-called first to file and first to invent. So one of the first arguments made in favor of first to file is that of harmonization, that the rest of the world generally operates on a first-to-file approach, and so switching the U.S. will harmonize the U.S. with the rest of the world. I think the gains from that harmonization may turn out to be very illusory for a couple of reasons. It turns out that, in fact, the rest of the world, as David Olson pointed out, are not indeed the same in their approach towards first to file. And the degree to which they are not the same is actually pretty large, not pretty small. So, for example, each major patent system in the world, including our present one and our potential future one, deal with a topic that goes generally by two labels, so-called statutory bar or so-called grace period. This statutory bar or grace period is an approach that basically says we, the patent systems of the world, want to perhaps allow some activities by an inventor to not bar the inventor from getting a patent if they occur before filing, and others to count as a bar if they occur before filing. And so, in fact, when you look around the world, and Professor Joseph Strauss, a leading European academic who studies patent systems, has done careful studies of the grace periods and statutory bars around the world, what he has found is that those countries who say they do have a big grace period, in fact, either don't or have a small one, and those who say they don't, in fact, do and in some cases have big ones. And so a great degree of the harmonization benefit that we think we'd be picking up, in fact, we might not be picking up, and I think would not be picking up, because the rest of the world is not so harmonized with itself. And that's on really big, important issues like what activities count before filing, because we all do recognize that no serious filing of a document can occur unless the document was written first, and no serious writing of a document can occur unless someone was kicking around those ideas before they wrote about them. And quite often people are writing about, kicking around, testing, sampling, and engaging in conversations, and it's all of those type of natural preliminary activities that are the ball game and the devil's in the details of statutory bars and grace periods. So that's why I think harmonization is a not, at least for me, an unconvincing argument about harmonization. The efficiency argument. Yes.
Scott, this is Tim. I just wanted to add something else to the harmonization point, if I could.
Please.
I just wanted to, before you moved on to off of harmonization, I just wanted to add a complimentary concern about the proposals that currently stands about harmonization, if that's okay.
Please.
Again, this is Tim Holbrook. That's one concern that I have with the first-to-file system as proposed in the pending legislation, is that we're moving unilaterally. And even though in the abstract I'm an internationalist, I probably would favor first-to-file in the abstract, in its current form, we're doing this without getting any form of deeper harmonization with our trading partners. In earlier iterations of this bill, there were some permutations where we would wait until we got a grace period from Europe or Japan or other trading partners. That's not present in the current bill. And so I think Scott's absolutely correct that the level, the depth of the harmonization we would achieve is pretty thin. And by making this move unilaterally, it removes a bargaining chip to actually advance future efforts to harmonize on issues of novelty, on issues of the grace period. So again, while I abstract, I think there are advantages to first to file, I think as in its present form, the harmonization rationale is problematic.
Do you wish to respond to that, Professor Keefe, before you go on to David Olson's other points?
No. In fact, I was going to say I echo those points that Tim Holbrook was making. I feel badly with the two of us taking airtime from David Olson, who sponsored the original points. If he wants to rebut them, we maybe should give him a chance.
This is David. Yeah, don't feel badly at all. That's the point of this discussion. So I take your points that we'll there will not be perfect harmony. I'm not sure. I hadn't thought a lot about Tim's point that maybe we're harmonizing without, you know, getting more harmonization back in other areas. Whether, you know, are we giving away a chit too easily that we could use to extract some other sort of value? I just really haven't thought a lot about that. It doesn't seem like to me that it should be a big concern for passing this legislation or not, but I'll kind of leave it at that. The only point I'd make is that even if some disharmony exists worldwide, and even if it would continue to exist, I think us moving to first to file, I don't think it's arguable that that's at least a step towards or provides some greater degree of harmonization than now exists. And that's all I'll say about that, because I have to be honest, the harmonization rationale for first to file is to me the least compelling of the various rationale. But since I'm the one on the call who's supposed to outline the arguments for first to file, I thought I would give them all.
Well, who would like to respond then to Professor Olson's other arguments, which I will summarize as all dealing with simplification. Number one, simplifying the patent application and granting process. Number two, simplifying litigation. And number three, simplifying the problems of Section 102 G2 prior art.
Sure. So this is Scott. I'll take an initial crack and let others chime in, if that's okay. So then the first cut at the efficiency argument should, I think, at least be seen as one member of a broad class of arguments that get made about efficiency versus more searching reviews in a range of systems that encourage so-called races. So, for example, there's a lot of areas of private law and public law in the United States, like what are called key TAM actions, actions where the governmental body in charge, federal or state, will say X, Y, or Z is illegal. It will then say to itself, we don't have the prosecutorial resources to police this carefully, and so we will encourage private citizens to either mount their own lawsuits or, in effect, stand in as lawyers for us bringing government lawsuits. And then those private citizens who bring those lawsuits enforcing our laws get a piece of the pie in the collection that's made on behalf of the government. And in these actions are called key TAM actions. And one of the big debates in the key TAM area is the debate between those who say the person who gets the reward should be the one who files the first lawsuit on the one hand, and those on the other hand who say, but whoa, wait a minute, a really badly brought lawsuit doesn't help the public, doesn't help the government, holds up the courts in unending litigation, and it'd be much better to give the award to somebody who brings a lawsuit that's actually carefully researched, carefully prepared, and factually very well founded. And so you end up with these very big battles between those who were filing first, and often in a file-first system there's a race to file, so lots of people have fairly anemic filings. And then you have the kind of good filing that had the good investigation. My general view is the exact same thing plays out in the patent system, which is that if you encourage people to file first, you get filings that are regrettably anemic. They're thin. They're not deep, rich filings. And in the patent system, one of the core elements of the rules for patent validity or patentability is that the originally filed patent application must have a rich disclosure in the U.S. system. That's 35 U.S.C. Section 112, first paragraph, that refers to, that sets forth those disclosure requirements. And one of the big difficulties in every patent system is trying to figure out what the eventually issued patent means and what its boundaries are. And the basic approach in the U.S. and in many other countries is to look back to the initial filing. And if the initial filing is a deep, rich, and clear filing, then you can, on average, have a decent shot at getting patents that are themselves protected by claims that are broad, powerful in their breadth, and yet clear in giving notice. And one of the things that happens when you switch to a first-to-file system, I think we will see in the U.S. a set of patents that will emerge that will, generally speaking, not be particularly broad, and that's really bad, or they will be given breadth by courts who will feel badly about interpreting them narrowly, but the courts will have to do so in an ad hoc way, and that will create a large degree of uncertainty for both patentees and infringers, reminiscent of the debates we've long had around the so-called doctrine of equivalence. And so you'll get out of the so-called efficiency gains of a quick decision around filing date a big inefficiency of either A, no broad patents, or B, patents of total uncertainty, and that will be very bad for the system overall. In addition, the few entities who will generally have the type of patent attorney staff on file, ready, willing, and able to deploy long hours into the night drafting an emergency, long, detailed patent applications will be the very large established players that the patent system should not be tilted in favor of protecting. Large established companies deserve patents just like small market challenging companies, but there's no reason to tilt the patent system entirely in their favor, and a race to file will tilt the patent system largely in favor of these very, very big companies. The last point that was then made was the point about the difficulties of finding so-called 102G art, so-called semi-secret art. This is prior art that exists out there that's not as public as a published document, but is more public than a secret or concealed or suppressed activity. And while it is correct to point out that it is expensive to go find that prior art, I think there is a social benefit to allowing those activities to count as prior art. Activities such as those, activities that are not in fact kept secret, are activities that are not the subject of an invidious game by an individual to seek trade secret protection before seeking patent protection and thereby unfairly extend patent term, but rather they are the subject of an activity by definition that's not secret. That's the only way it would count as 102G art. And since it's not secret, there's a good chance third parties, neither the patentee nor the one engaging the activity, but some third party could observe that activity, think that because they're observing it outside of a patent, think that it's therefore not patented, and make an investment in reliance on that. And I think that treating those activities as 102G prior art protects the reasonable reliance of those third parties, and that's why it should count as prior art, although it is expensive to go find.
Well, having heard all those arguments, does anyone care to respond or offer further insights?
This is Tim Holbrook. I'm kind of realizing why I became a professor and left litigation. There's some aspects of what Scott said that I agree with, some I disagree with. And so if you'll indulge me a little bit, I agree with Scott about the bias towards big companies. And I think there's almost, you could argue, an expressive component to this as well, that the first two event system says, look, we cherish the sort of romantic individual inventor idea, and that we actually reward those who come up with ideas and work hard. I think there's value to that. I do think having that in our law has sort of, maybe it's not something you monetize, but I think there's a certain expressive value to that. So I agree not only with the skewing in favor, but also the cost of shifting away from the idea of the potential small inventor. With respect to the efficiency gains that Scott mentioned, I think he's right on the margins that there's now an incentive to get to the patent office quickly, but I'm not certain how big of a cost that will be. There's even in our first to invent system, I think there's a lot of incentive to file quickly. I don't know many patent applicants that would be happy to bank the value, the validity of their entire patent on arguing I was first to file or the first to invent. They want to get to the patent office quickly. So I think there is already procedural advantages and a lot of other benefits to filing quickly in our current system that the switch to first to file, I don't know how that it's going to result in these grossly underdeveloped disclosures that Scott's suggesting, particularly given that we have lots of international filings in the United States as well, where those applicants are operating under a first-to-file system. You know, is there concern to the quality of the disclosures? Potentially, but I don't know that the switch is going to be so, in such magnitude that it outweighs the potential benefits, efficiency benefits that we get from having first-to-file, elimination of interference concerns, that sort of thing.
Gentlemen, if
so
we may, why don't we...
I was going to say, if I could, this is Scott, if I could just quickly jump in very briefly, because I don't want to hold us up on the constitutional stuff too much, but if I could just briefly address Tim's point. I hear the point about lots of existing applications already getting filed out of domestic and foreign motivations to simply be first to file, and the presence of those as a large number of patents in our system is not inconsistent with the point that under our present system, in addition, there is still some quite real degree of comfort that somebody could take from the decision that they might choose to instead just go a little bit more slowly, and under the existing system, you in effect have a year, to take care in drafting a much richer disclosure. And so, yes, you do get a lot of patents under the existing system that are focused on first to file anyway, but that the concern I have is that you would wipe out of the system the significant, probably small percentage, but significant percentage of very, very commercially significant patents that are seeking very, very broad scope and wrote very, very rich disclosures. So put differently, many international filers in the U.S. are filing under focus on patent systems around the world, and then they, on the margin, don't have to spend very much to also file in the U.S. So since they are paying a lot of attention to the rules around the rest of the world, that's what drives their behavior. And having let that drive their behavior, it makes sense to just also go ahead at the same time and file in the U.S. But the focus, I think, here should be on the different decision. It's those who are rationally choosing not to worry so much about the rights they might obtain in the rest of the world, and instead do bank a fair amount on the chance that they're going to get a really good patent by filing a really rich disclosure and take some comfort in taking some time to write that deep, rich disclosure in the U.S.
Would anyone care to address any other policy or administrative cost arguments before we move on to the constitutional questions?
Thank you, David. This is David Olson. I would like to say a couple of things. So with regard to what Scott was just talking about, the race to the patent office resulting in thin or anemic patent disclosures, just a few points. First, and Scott kind of pre-butted this some by saying that some people aren't going to care about international filing. But of course, for those who do care about international filing, they already have the motivation to race to the patent office, and they're going to have the same kind of patent filings if we change the first to file that they have now, because if you're filing internationally, you have to race. Secondly, I think there's some worry about the results. There's some assumptions about what the system will do, but there's not really evidence. So I haven't seen any clear dispositive evidence that U.S. patents, you know, that are better than Japanese or European patents in ways are broader, are clearer. And given all the debate that's gone on around this, I would think that if there were clear evidence on that, it certainly would have come out by now. Likewise, with the big companies versus small inventors, the people on this call I know are all sophisticated and have a sophisticated understanding of patent law, but I think for some members of Congress, perhaps, and some members of the general public, there's almost a mythic kind of idea that our current system really protects small inventors, the small, you know, garage inventor who can just invent something and therefore, you know, that's really important, and almost without more go out and you know, achieve the American dream. Of course, the reality is under either system, if you want to have robust patent rights that you're either going to license or build a company around, you're going to have to spend money to get a patent. You're going to have to gain some sophistication about how the patent system works, as well as lots of business sophistication and whatnot. And again, there's no good evidence that first to file does advantage small players as opposed to large players. Finally, on the rush to file, I think that patent lawyers will deal pretty well with this potential alleged problem of anemic disclosures. I was just at a seminar yesterday that a law firm put on, or a kind of conference on startups and IP, and people there were talking about their strategies that they use now if they're worried that their client or needs to make a disclosure or might have made a disclosure earlier. They can file a provisional patent. Someone was saying you can file them for as cheaply as $200. You put that patent in, it gives you the disclosure might be somewhat anemic, but you know, you look around, if no one has come along and filed a patent you know, in the next month to however long it takes you to write out your broader disclosures, then you can file another patent or you file a continuation in part, all of which patent lawyers are very good at in the U.S. And so I think there are ways that patent lawyers, being very good at their jobs, will still be able to get broad patents, still be able to get in broad disclosures. So I think that there's kind of a fear of what's going to happen if we change systems that there's not evidence of, kind of from comparing to the rest of the world, and that I think is probably somewhat misfounded. But, you know, again, that's just us kind of disagreeing on what's an empirical assumption on both parts.
So I'll stick to my promise to protect Adam's time and just give 60 seconds. On the first point, it has long been recognized that both the U.S. and Japan have very, very large numbers of very, very kind of slim or narrow patents, and yet only the U.S. has a small number of very, very big or so-called pioneering patents. And so I think that's just absolutely recognized in the literature, and we can talk more about that empirical data and debate it on a different time, but I do think it's pretty well established. On the question of can these things cost money, yes, a rich disclosure costs money, just like it costs money to have a team of patent lawyers ready to file. The difference is timing. Under the existing system, you have some time to raise that money. Under the new system, you would not have that time. You'd have to spend that money on the front end. And that's why your last point about provisionals is, I think, pure poison. The so-called provisional patent application was sold to the public as a way to write a patent application on a cocktail napkin, file it, and secure some rights. And everybody who's ever focused on those issues has realized that it is much better never to file a provisional patent application in substance. In substance, it's always better to file a deep, rich, genuine patent application and then merely tick the box that says it's provisional so that you get an extra year of secrecy out of the procedural process in the patent office associated with provisional patent applications. And that means provisional patent applications provide no substantive benefit to patentees and only procedural detriment to those who rightly complain about submarine patent applications.
Professor Mossoff, do you have any views on the constitutionality of anything that's been talked about here?
Well, yeah, I think this policy discussion is excellent, and the policy issues are obviously very relevant in analyzing statutes and court decisions and whatnot. But I think that people tend to forget that we have a patent system because it is rooted in the Constitution. We do not have a pure common law patent system, and thus efficiency arguments are not the only thing that matter in the same way that they may matter in talking about standard common law property rights. In this respect, I don't think the first to invent is policy that we've had in this country is just rhetoric, as the way Tim characterized it in his remarks, that you know that we makes us feel good, it sounds good. I think it is rooted in both the history and in the construction of the constitutional clause in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, that in which Congress is told that it can, quote, promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries, end quote. It does not say Congress has the power to pass patents and copyright statutes in order to ensure overall social utility, unquote. If it said that, then I would be totally on board with just the pure policy arguments, but I don't think that that's correct. And in fact, as an historical matter, the U.S. Very quickly created an original patent system, a unique patent system, was part of the American exceptionalism of the 18th and 19th centuries, in which inventor meant first inventor. Following on Samuel Johnson's 1785 dictionary, where inventor is defined as, quote, one who produces something new, a deviser of something not known before, or he also defines a discoverer as one that finds anything unknown before, Congress recognized that inventor Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, meant a first inventor. And this is actually reflected in the drafting of the bill that became the Patent Act of 1790, in which Representative Thomas Fitzsimmons wrote that, quote, the sixth section allowing importers was left out, the constitutional power being questionable, end quote. Now, the reason why people were considering permitting patents for imports and not just patents for first inventors is because patents for imports was actually what existed under the English patent system. And in England, patents were extended to inventors, and they define inventors as people who actually created something new, as well as people who imported them. Now, England thus had a very different approach to patents than the Americans. England viewed patents as personal privileges granted by the crown, essentially monopoly privileges, that were deemed to be exceptions to common law rights to property and to free trade. The American approach to patents was dramatically different. They immediately defined in both the statutes and in court decisions patents as property rights, not as monopoly grants. And the impact of this was extremely important. It resulted in them institutionalizing patents under the rule of law. Thus, for instance, in the antebellum era, they create the patent office that issues patents under pre-existing legal rules set forth in federal statutes and in case law. This was opposed to the English approach, where patents were deemed to be issued at the prerogative of the crown, and it was a discretionary power. In other words, what the federal government did was it replicated title recordation and publication practices from the real property system in the patent system. Now, the reason why they were doing this, as I said, is that because they were conceptualizing patents as property rights. And thus, for instance, they refer to patents as title deeds, the root and moral justification of a title deed being the inchoate property right that's created through first possession. They thus applied property concepts to patent law throughout the 19th century. They referred to multiple owners of patents as tenants in common. They immediately, starting in the early 19th century, referred to infringement as trespass. They adopted property rhetoric, referring to infringers. This is Chief Justice Story, Chief Justice Bushrod Washington, and others referring to infringement as piracy. And they repeatedly, as a result of this, invoked the normative rhetoric from natural rights philosophy that the policy of the patent law was to secure to patentees the fruits of their inventive labors. Now, this is all very significant because this entire scheme in which they were applying to and incorporating into patent law real property concepts, real property rhetoric, and also real property doctrines. As I said, they immediately secured patents as property rights providing for injunctions, similar to injunctions that could issue for claims of trespass. They incorporated into patent law in the antebellum era the same conveyance doctrines that existed in real property, permitting patentees to carve up their rights into lesser rights and to impose various restrictions that they analogize to restrictive covenants and lesser estates in the real property context at common law. And even more importantly, they broke with England on providing constitutional protection to patents. And thus, in the 19th century, a question arose whether unauthorized use of a patent by the government would give rise to a claim under the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause for just compensation for the patentee. England said that since patents were personal privileges granted by the Crown always reserved the right to use the subject matter of the patent grant. In these cases, the invention. The American courts are very aware of this. They cited to this. The arguments were made in the courts to the in the court cases, and the judges explicitly broke with this and instead held that patents were secured as property under the Fifth Amendment because patents were property rights on par with tangible property interests. Now, again, the reason why this is very important is this whole framework that we now take for granted, which now forms the content of much of what we think of the patent system today, since this has existed for 100 years, if not longer, we all take this for granted, but this entire framework would not have been made possible but for the fact that we recognize that it was the first inventor to obtain, who justifiably has the claim to a patent. And thus, for instance, Chief Justice John Marshall in 1813, in a riding circuit, wrote in an opinion that the, quote, Constitution and law taken together give to the inventor from the moment of invention an inchoate property therein, which is completed by suing out a patent, end quote. The Constitution and law taken together, meaning that an inventor identified in the Constitution implemented through the 1790 Patent Act, 1793 Patent Act, 1836 Patent Act, 1870, all the way up to the 1952 Patent Act, repeatedly reaffirming that what we secure are first inventors. And thus, you'll hear the argument that, well, the constitutional phrase doesn't say first inventors. Well, for the Americans working at the time, per Samuel Johnson's dictionary and other statements by Madison and others, it would have been redundant to say first inventors. And when they do, it was merely for rhetorical purposes. It was to emphasize the importance that the presumption in the Constitution, the constitutional presumption, is that we give to first inventors. Now, a lot of the rules that you heard the identified by David, the cases in which there are instances in which under the law that a patent doesn't go to a first inventor, and as he talked about them, some of these are very complex legal regimes that you have in terms of the interference actions and whatnot. Those follow out of the derivative application of follow-on concepts. Thus, for instance, in the 19th century, the question came up of what counts as an invention, and they had to decide, is it a date of conception when an inventor thinks of an invention, or is it the date of reduction to practice? And they decided to settle on reduction of practice as the definitive mark for when someone could claim a date of invention, even though the date of conception was struggled with this at times to vie for as the mark of an invention. And thus, under 103G, yes, the second reducer to practice can get the invention if he can also show earlier date of conception. But the follow-on rules that show that inventors don't always get patents follow on either post-invention activities by the inventors, so public use or suppression of an invention, so they're being punished under the law given their post-invention activities, or they follow on the fact that we've had to make follow-on decisions out of the legal concepts and terms of art that we have developed in patent law. And that makes sense because that's exactly what we see throughout all other constitutional clauses. There's a right of due process. But we also have a statute of limitations. So we wouldn't say, oh, well, there's only a qualified right of due process under the Constitution because there's a statute of limitations. There's a right to vote. But we wouldn't say, oh, it's only a qualified right to vote because felons are prohibited from voting. And that's a significant portion of our population. It's 2% of the adult population, 4.7 million adults are prohibited from voting. We wouldn't say we only have a qualified right of free speech under the First Amendment because time, manner, place regulations might prohibit people from speaking. The point is that the Constitution sets forth the presumption in its various limitations and grants of powers, and it's in the copyright and patent context, the patent context, it's the presumption of first to invent.
But doesn't Article 1, Section 8 just give Congress the option to create a patent system rather than required to do so? Mm-hmm. And given that, is there any constitutional reason why Congress could not define who as is an inventor as the first inventor to file, just as in effect we now have the first inventor to reduce the invention to practice.
Right. I have two answers to that. This is an excellent question. The first answer is that all grants of power in the Constitution are discretionary grants. None of the clauses in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution mandate that Congress do anything. Congress is not mandated to create a Navy. It's empowered to provide and maintain a Navy. Congress is not mandated to establish post offices and post roads. It's empowered to do so and has the choice to do so. In fact, very importantly, it's granted the power under Section 8, Clause 9 to, quote, to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. The majority of our federal judicial system are discretionary grants by Congress under its grant of enumerated power in Section 8, Clause 9. And so Congress, of course, could have the ability to pass laws, not create inferior courts to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then deny the U.S. Supreme Court in these laws jurisdiction to rule on these things. It could do that, and it would be constitutional for it to do it. We can then normatively evaluate that as being incorrect, and I think it would be proper to do so. And so Congress can choose to create a patent system under Article 1, Clause 8, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8. But if it does create a patent system, then Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 defines the terms by which it can then create that patent system. A patent system has to provide an exclusive right to inventors for a limited time. It limits the patent system that it can create, and it has to follow those the limits of those terms. And secondly, in response to the question, well, can it just define inventor as as the first inventor to file? None of the constitutional clauses tell Congress how to define its terms. It has to be construed. This is why the Supreme Court looks to the Federalist Papers, Samuel Johnson's Dictionary, the first acts of Congress, the legislative history to the first acts of Congress and whatnot, to understand what is the original meaning of these phrases, because the Constitution is not a statute with a section that defines its terms. It sets forth terms that we then have to understand how they may be applied and applying the presumptions that are set forth in the document itself.
Would anyone else care to weigh in on the constitutional merits of the proposed first-to-file system?
This is Tim Holbrook. I'd like to discuss it a little bit, and I wanted to start first with one response to what Adam had to say about my argument that first to file was rhetorical and just rhetorical force. That wasn't my point at all. My point was that it's actually a cultural value that is meaningful and has significance to us, not that it's just rhetoric. With respect to the constitutional question, I think it is important to note that even the definition from back then talked about whether an invention is known or not, sort of begs the question, right? If two people create independently an invention in secret, does that mean only one is the inventor, right? What does it mean to be known? So I don't think it necessarily does all the work that we would like for it to do. I think second, the reality is for hundreds of years, or for at least over 100 years, we haven't given patent at all times to the first person to factually invent. We sort of glossed over this abandonment, suppression, concealment aspect of 102G, but if the first to invent abandons, suppresses, conceals, they don't get the patent, and the second to invent does get the patent. It's not as if we say no one gets the patent. We actually reward someone else who is the second to invent, which we've done that for hundreds of years. That seems to be okay, unless those who think that the first to file system is unconstitutional. If you want to suggest that practice is also unconstitutional, that's fine. But it's hard for me to see the leap from what we have done first to invent, except abandonment, suppression, or concealment, means the second to invent gets the patent. Similarly, until the mid-90s, we discriminated against foreign applicants. They could not use their evidence of inventive activity outside of the United States to prove they were the first to invent. So a U.S. applicant who is technically the second to invent could get the patent, not the true de facto first to invent who is overseas. So historically, we've had recognition that the first to invent is not always entitled to the patent. At times, the second to invent is. Now, Adam mentioned that, well, those are post-invention activities, sort of like statutory or statutes of limitations. I don't see that as any different than saying, fine, the post-inventive activity that you now must satisfy is filing first, right? There's nothing in here that says we're going to reward patents to people who have no connection to the act of invention at all, right? I think, you know, the derivation provisions in the Patent Act confirm that. I think there's an interesting argument whether the word inventor requires the derivation protections, right, that you can't take from somebody else. But to me, it seems that we have this history of granting to people who are granting the patent to people who are the second to invent. And so I'm not quite certain how, unless those are unconstitutional, which could be the case, it seems to me that we have this long practice of allowing Congress to place conditions on persons who are inventors in order to actually be the winner of the patent. In the past, it's don't abandon, suppress, or conceal. Under the current legislation, it's be the first to file. All people who are in play are potential inventors. They did actually create something. We're just setting the conditions it takes to get the patent. To me, that's a question of degree. And unless 102G is unconstitutional, and unless the historical discrimination against foreign applicants is also unconstitutional, it's hard for me to see how the term inventor suddenly forces us into a first-to-invent system.
Professor Mossoff, would you care to respond briefly?
Oh, sure. I think Tim has raised some really good points, and any proper explanation of the constitutional basis of first to invent would have to accommodate them. I think they can be accommodated. The foreign laws one is the easy. The accommodation of foreign inventors inventing in foreign countries is perhaps the easiest one to respond to. And the response to that is simply that it was long recognized, even reaching back to the first Patent Act in 1790, that the Constitution only applies within the jurisdictional boundaries of the United States. And thus, it's merely an act of comedy for Congress to permit foreign inventors who are living and working and inventing in foreign countries to even apply for U.S. patents. in fact, there had to be special laws, special statutes enacted to permit foreign inventors to apply for patents within the U.S. And this makes sense. The Constitution, as I said, applies to within the jurisdictional boundaries of the United States. And so to the extent to where we accommodate first to file systems in other countries for providing for dates of invention, to the extent to which we have to enter into treaties to obtain protection for U.S. inventions in other countries and vice versa, other countries' inventors' protection in the United States. This is an area of international law. This is not an area that falls under the scope of the powers provided to Congress in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, which is about federal law that applies to citizens or inventors living within the U.S. jurisdiction.
This is, Scott, to just, if I could very, very briefly jump in that in addition to what Adam and Tim are debating, I just pass along an interesting historical fact that I learned recently from a new book out about the Confederate patent system, that apparently the U.S. Justice Department's Attorney General issued a formal opinion during the pre-Civil War era that African American slaves were ineligible to be classified as inventors entitled to claim a patent under the Constitution because they were slaves, and therefore their masters could not file for those inventions because they were not the inventors, and therefore nobody could file.
That's interesting because that runs counter to actually the U.S. court's interpretation of the requirement that an inventor obtain a patent, and they actually held that slaves could file for patents under federal law in the Union. And just to emphasize again the point to which they recognize patents as property, and as I said, Congress had to enact special statutes to be added to the Patent Acts to permit foreign inventors to apply for patents in the United States. One of these statutes was the bill was actually introduced in the House by Daniel Webster, and his justification for why the U.S. should recognize the right of foreign inventors to apply for U.S. patents was a natural rights justification. In his speech in which he introduced this legislation, he announced that, quote, "The right of the inventor is a high property. It is the fruit of his mind. It belongs to him more than any other property, and he ought to be protected in the enjoyment of it," end quote. So recognizing that this was an area of comedy, they still acknowledged that the force, the moral force of the argument here was that this person has come up with something new, they've created it, and we are going to recognize that and secure it, or at least we should. In response to the second point about that, that in interference actions, that the actual invention, that interference actions, the actual property right in the invention, can in some circumstances go to a second inventor and not the first inventor, given certain actions by the first post-invention actions by the first inventor. And whether that is unconstitutional, I don't think that that's unconstitutional, because they set up the whole system on the presumption, and that's again the emphasis is the presumption. What is the presumption of the system? That the first inventor initially has the right, barring follow-on actions. Now, in interference actions, the problem that you have is you have two people who have filed for a patent. And neither of them have publicly disclosed it, so the invention is not in the public domain, and thus they're both claiming a right to the invention, and you have a battle over who has the right. And the steps that they go through are: okay, who was the first to conceive, and then reduce, and then if a later person reduced practice could still get it if he had an earlier date of first conception. And then the next step after all that is, yeah, but if that person was still the still engaged in abandonment, suppression, or concealment, in other words, they committed laches, similar to a statute of limitations type argument, then it will go to the other person because you have two applicants here. It's a very unusual circumstance, and they recognize it as an unusual circumstance, and they set up a series of rules that are based upon the default presumption that the invention should still go to the first inventor. I think that you can easily accommodate that in the exact same way that you can accommodate statutes of limitations under the due process clauses of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment, the same way you can accommodate time, manner, place regulations under the First Amendment, in all those instances, sometimes people don't have the right to engage in free speech, but yet we don't then say, oh, that's unconstitutional. Some people might claim that's unconstitutional, but I think the court's arguments for that are recognize that in operationalizing the bare terms of what are provided in the Constitution, that you need additional derivative rules and you need to contextualize them in a way that makes sense. And we've done this throughout all the other areas of the Constitution, and I don't see the problem or the difficulty in recognizing that the same presumption and derivative application rules issue still applies in the context of the patent system.
Gentlemen, I think that's as good a point as any to wind up this fascinating and erudite discussion. I want to say thank you to Professors Adam Mossoff, Scott Keefe, David Olson, and Tim Holbrook, and thanks to all of you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this Federalist Society Intellectual Property Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.